Well, as all the other speakers, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. So I only arrived on Monday. I apologize, I haven't had time to meet with everyone yet. So I'll be talking about some of our recent data on mostly clinical and experimental data on human ventricular fibrillation dynamics. But then, given some of the discussions on Monday and then Elizabeth's presentation yesterday, I thought it would also be interesting to show some of our recent work on 3D optical imaging, and which stems back from longstanding collaboration with Arkady when I was a postdoc in his lab. So let me start with the new non-invasive mapping of VF in patients. So just a short introduction. As you all know, sudden cardiac death is a major cause of mortality. It's over 350,000 deaths per year in Europe or North America alone. In France, it's one death every 10 minutes. And in, well, according to different reports, goes from 20 to 80% of the cases, it seems to be associated with cardiac rhythm disturbances and ventricular fibrillation. This is actually a Holter recording from one of our patients who unfortunately died during her sleep. And as you can see, she had many premature ventricular contractions, and unfortunately one was badly timed and triggered ventricular arrhythmia that very rapidly degenerated into ventricular fibrillation. We know now for many years, this is a study by Haikuri from 2001, the numbers haven't changed much since then, but that heart failure, coronary artery disease, myocardial infarction, are pathologies associated with a high incidence of ventricular fibrillation. However, in absolute numbers, the main cases of sudden cardiac death occur in the general population in people with very often no prior cardiovascular history. So there's a big challenge here in identifying the patients or the people, these are not necessarily patients, the people at risk of dying suddenly due to ventricular fibrillation. So now, what is ventricular fibrillation? Well,
do you know why that patient was wearing the Holter tape?
She had some palpitations, she had symptoms of these PVCs. During the standard ECG in the ward, they actually didn't see any, and then she had an episode at night where she had many, like you can see here, almost every second or 2 seconds.
She wasn't real sick.
She wasn't really sick, no. She had her MRI was absolutely normal, but then, fortunately, this is quite rare, but it does happen, and she died due to ventricular fibrillation. So we've heard a lot about VF dynamics and experimental studies. I mean, the basic concepts of VF dynamics were known already from the late 1800s, early 1900s with Mines, Lewis, who had introduced the notions of focal ectopic activity or rotors, reentrant activity, whether it's macroscopical or functional. Now, animal studies have confirmed this partly, but also shown a wide variety of different types of dynamics of VF. So some of the early optical mapping studies in rabbit heart by Rick Gray, Arkady, Pepe Halife, showed that a single scroll wave, meandering scroll wave, could give rise to VF-like ECG patterns. Pig studies, for example, Matt has worked on quantifying ventricular fibrillation in isolated pig hearts, showing a much more complex picture with many more. So here, every red dot is a phase singularity. So many more rotors or scroll waves interacting with each other in a very complex fashion. So VF is much more, appears to be much more complex in pig than in rabbits. Then again, another species, guinea pig. This is work by Pepe Halife, showing the model rotor, where you have a region of a high frequency rotor with a very high dominant frequency, and then you have fibrillatory propagation away from this model rotor. And then yet another type of behavior that has been observed in this case using plunge needle electrodes. This is from Ray Eidecker's lab with arrays of plunge needles, showing that he observed in dog intramural reentry, for example, but he also observed focal activity driving ventricular fibrillation, especially focal activity coming from the endocardial side. So you see here activity going from the bottom endocardium all the way up to the epicardium, so presumably implicating the Purkinje system in focally driving VF. And there appears to be also a time course of rotor versus focal activity in these experiments.
What animal
was that? This is dog. So it's here four different species, four different type of dynamics that have been described in the literature. Now, what about the human heart? So it's, of course, it's very difficult to study EF in the patient. So there's a couple of studies. So this is a work by Martin Nash, Peter Taggart. This is during open chest surgery in patients which undergo either bypass surgery or valve replacement. So they were able to fit a sock, a multi-electrode sock, on the epicardium of those hearts. So they were on extracellular extracorporeal circulation. So they wouldn't have any consequences from the VF episodes that were induced. But they were able to epicardially map VF in these patients. So these are fairly sick patients, very diseased hearts. And so these are bullseye views, meaning the ventricular apex is right in the center and the base is at the periphery. And so they saw different types of behaviors with episodes where you have something that looks like a mother rotor, a single stable high-frequency rotor, and other episodes where you have multiple rotors interacting with each other. But the bottom line was that compared to other large mammalian species like the pig, there seems to be a fairly low number of rotors in the human heart, and not like what has been observed in pig or in other large species.
The sock is in the endocardium?
It's epicardial. So it's open chest surgery, and they fit a sock.
How far apart the electrodes are?
The interactive distance, I could check it up in the paper. It's probably, I would say, anywhere between 5 and millimeter and 1 centimeter, something like that. But I don't remember the exact numbers. And then there's a couple of studies who have looked at, so this is from Nantakumar's lab, a collaboration with Pepe Khalifi as well, looking at VF in explanted human donor hearts. So they had a couple of papers published on this, and here again, it was more like a concept that you indeed see rotors. Here you see figure of 8 re-entry, but only a few rotors, 2-3 rotors underlying VF in the human heart. But still, there is very little information available in patients and in broad patient populations, so not only patients with very sick hearts and structurally altered hearts. Just as a side note, Sasha Pantelov actually some time ago did a simple estimation. So we've talked about wavelength and scales in the heart, and so he actually was interested in how the spiral wavelength or the wavelength of a spiral wave compared to the size of a heart. And so does a spiral wave for a given species fit into the heart of that given species, and how many can actually fit? And so this is a very simple simulation based on a 2D square domain with a spiral, so it's not 3D. But still, he found that in pig and in dog, you can fit more spiral waves than actually in rabbit and human. And in terms of how many spiral waves can fit into the heart, the conclusion of this study was that rabbit was actually much closer to human than other large species like dog and pig. So confirms somewhat the experimental studies that I've shown before, but still a lot of things unknown about human
VF. Yes, experimental data or it's numerical?
Well, he took this is numerical. This is all numerical.
He used a numerical model for each species.
For each species, yes. Based on given sizes of the heart for each species.
And S is what?
It's this is basically a ratio, I think, of the spiral wavelength versus the scalar dimension, the size of the.
I mean, we know that the wavelength is irrelevant, right? So the separation between, you know, how many spiral pores or spiral filaments you can have.
Yeah.
I know. It's not defined by the wavelength.
I know. It's a first approximation, I would say. If you have a spiral wave, which is a single arm, basically just one turn of the spiral wave, can it actually fit into a given domain of a given size?
I want to make a comment here, because I don't think that this the wavelength is a good still estimate. Yeah. If you divide by pi, you get the response function or score diameter, which is irrelevant.
It's not because those two things are completely separate from each other. The core size and the wavelength, they're absolutely unrelated.
We'll discuss that later.
They're not entirely unrelated. I mean, the simplest old model is the minimum refractory period times the conduction velocity gives you the linear core, you know, sort of where the spiral tip and sort of meander, and that's not so different from the wavelengths. I mean, they're not exactly the same thing, but but I think a better estimate would be a minimum refractory period times conduction velocity.
Yeah.
It's called Wiener's wavelengths.
Yeah, exactly. Wiener's
can I have one? I would say size of the response function is the characteristic, but you can't see it.
Okay.
And that is just, Roman, that is confirmation from your talk. Size of the response function. Yes.
But this was a very simple way of just estimating. It's still, interestingly, on a human is close to rabbit, and it seems to corroborate experimental data, at least in terms of numbers of rotors.
And in the study, they explanted the heart of Natha Kumar. What did they see? They saw also a few rotors?
Few rotors, yes. Anywhere between 2 and 5, I think, on a whole human heart. Human
you see on the surface, it would be long filaments, winding.
So the limitations of both these studies, and also what I'll show for more clinical data, is that it's only epicardial view. So, of course, it's not a perfect mapping study. So in this talk, I would like to focus on the non-structural heart disease patient and how VF in an apparently normal heart, actually, what the dynamics are of VF in a structurally normal heart. So in terms of patient population, there are two groups of patients that would qualify within this definition of non-structural heart disease. So first of all, what some groups call primary electrical disorders. So these are patients with a structurally normal heart but with electrophysiological alterations. So you all know about long and short QT, CPVT, J-wave syndromes. I'll say something about this. So Brugada, early repolarization syndromes, which are thought to be purely electrical disorders without structural alterations. And then there is also this whole group of patients with so-called idiopathic ventricular fibrillation. So these are patients where actually we don't know why they develop ventricular fibrillation. Everything is absolutely normal in these patients in terms of cardiac function, electrophysiology, so they have normal ECG, normal MRI, CT scan, coronary angiogram. In Bordeaux, on top of that, they undergo pharmacological testing, so Agmarine, sodium channel blockers, isoproterenol, just to induce some stress and see whether they develop some arrhythmias. So in these patients with idiopathic ventricular fibrillation, everything is absolutely normal.
Agmarine is the sodium channel blocker.
It's a sodium channel blocker, yeah. It's typically used to unmask or emphasize Brugada type syndrome, which is believed to be, in many cases, a sodium channel mutation.
Is there any systematic genetic profiling of those patients?
Yes, those will have, well, actually those as well, and in many cases there are known genetic mutations for us. But in these, yes, they will undergo genetic testing, so all this, of course, is excluded. And we have in our study, I won't show the genetic data, but we found some variants, but of unknown relevance, so we don't know whether it's actually doing anything. But they have no known mutation that causes cardiac electrical abnormalities.
And how many people is that per year? Or, well, per year, but not that time necessarily, it's diagnosed. And
it's actually, well, maybe Hiroshi can also comment on this, but it's
very rare.
It's
not rare in Bordeaux. It would be like incidence in the population, 1 out of 10,000?
Well, if you look at the U.S. Population, the total pie of sudden cardiac death is about 350,000 sudden cardiac arrest. And 60% of them don't make it to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And among the 40% make it to the hospital, among them about 20% have a VTV, a shock of arrhythmia. But the among, and then if you just go down on the list, there was only percentage, about the only 76,000 people have a shock of arrhythm who are resuscitated in the hospital. And then we're, among them, this is among the most rare conditions. So it's not a 1 in 1,000 or 10,000. It's very, very rare.
Yeah. Well, it's rare, but also the patient that we see is a small fraction of those that actually make it to the hospital, because the first line of action will be implanted defibrillator, and then they will only go to the EP lab if they have recurrence of VF, incessant recurrence of VF. So the cardiologists will try to see whether they can do anything, maybe ablate, find triggers, or find potentially a substrate that wasn't diagnosed earlier. So to give you an idea, Bordeaux is one of the largest European centers for VF ablation, and in idiopathic ventricular fibrillation over 5 years, we saw about 30 patients.
30?
30.
Do you have auto tapes on all of them?
Most of, I would say half of them. Not all of them.
So young patients?
The one we selected for this study are young patients, and I'll explain why.
So the reason you don't do auto tapes on all of them is because the clinicians don't think it's useful?
With this, I'm not a clinician, so I cannot answer.
Okay. Everybody receives the defibrillator. So having a defibrillator is like having Holter all the time. Mm-hmm. So whenever there's a sound not recording, it's going to be recorded.
No, it's not, because it doesn't give detailed information about the 24-hour.
It's just an event recorder. It's just an event recorder.
When you define normal MRI and CT scan, so those are anatomical features, right?
Yeah.
Those are anatomical features. Do you have an estimate of the wall thickness of the ventricles?
Yes, this is all measured. So wall thickness, they will undergo delayed enhancement MRI to see whether there is any scarring. So wall thickness will be evaluated also to exclude hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, for example. So all this is looked at, yes.
What is the age group?
So the ones we investigated, I'll show in one of the next slides, the mean age was about 35 years old. And why 35 years old? Well, because basically in young adults, so in many different countries, there is a fairly high proportion of sudden unexplained death. So for example, this is a Danish study. You can see here sudden unexplained death comes right after coronary artery disease in persons aged 1 to 49 years old. Here, different. This is one study, but different U.S. registry, United Kingdom, and you can see sudden unexplained death is about 1/3 each time of all the cases of cardiac death. So unexplained meaning, at autopsy, everything seems to be perfectly normal, or in those cases where cases where patients have been resuscitated, everything appears to be normal. So the objective of the study was to characterize the main mechanisms involved in the maintenance of human idiopathic VF in vivo in patients. One of the hypotheses based on what we have seen from the experimental data available so far is that VF is probably underlied by a low number of potentially meandering rotors, scroll waves, without a specific location, because since the heart is structurally normal, there is no reason why the rotors would appear in a specific region. And so to test this hypothesis, and we recruited, so this was last year, we had 24 patients back then, so mean age of 34 years old. All the patients underwent non-invasive ECG mapping, so basically they would wear a vest of 252 electrodes that covered the whole surface of the torso, front and back. And during the AP procedure, they will also have simultaneous epi and endocardial contact mapping with catheters. That we have during the AP exploration, there are occurrences of spontaneous VF, but also VF will be induced in some of these patients by program stimulation, and then of course the patient will be defibrillated after 15 seconds. So this is kind of the time window we have to look at VF, so the first 15 seconds after that.
How do you do
epi below? So you just go below the rib cage and you enter a catheter in the pericardial space. So it's perhaps not the most common procedure, but it's used also, for example, in VT-related ablation. It's because for ablation from the endocardium in the ventricles, the ventricles being so thick, it can be quite challenging, first of all, to achieve transmural ablations. But also what you see on the endocardium might not be representative of what's happening on the epicardium, so you really need this to have this.
So these patients... So they show that they have VF, but they survive.
Yes, well, all the patients that come in the, for this kind of studies, they already have an implantable defibrillator. So.
How do they survive the, when they get the VF, why they survive, or how do they survive?
To get a shock, they've got a defibrillator.
It's not before, but
before.
They were hepatic, so they didn't know. So they
well, they, because somebody was there at the right moment to provide
reanimation
and shock, yeah. So it's by luck in a way.
Sorry, the tepe endo mapping is a local measure. How is the relative electrode?
It's local. It's we have different types of catheters, but it's you can consider this fairly local. So we have multi-electrode catheters that will have different splines that cover about this area, like a 2 centimeters square region. But here, the main point is that with the non-invasive ECGI, we can reconstruct by solution of an inverse problem the whole epicardial activity simultaneously of the ventricles. So of course, it has limitations. There is a lot of smoothing that so we lose information, and we also see the epicardium. But the big advantage is that it's a panoramic mapping, so you see the whole. Ventricle symmetry.
The multi-electrode mapping, tell us again how that works.
It's with a catheter, either through the femoral vein, goes into the cavity, or just under the.
And how many electrodes is that?
So different types of catheters. So,
so endocardial mapping is just a usual catheter, some probably about 4 or maybe 6 or maybe up to 10 bipolar catheter inside. And it's a sequential mapping, just like you're saying, during sine rhythm. So just one region at a time.
Yeah.
And then put the catheter out, and then an epicardial mapping, stick a catheter, and then some sideboard approach. And then probably you have seen that lasso catheter, a ring catheter.
Yeah.
That's what you do. And then it has a
10 point. Then you see
what
around also?
Yes.
Over the whole LV, or it's limited to.
No, entire
lumbar,
because the
both. Yeah. So there's two things in the invasive mapping that I'll show. So during the VF, it's only 15 seconds. You don't have time to go mapping. So all the catheters remain in place where they are at the moment of VF. But then in sinus rhythm, you'll see there is extensive mapping. So this is during sinus rhythm, they will sequentially, what Hiroshi just said, just map the whole surface endocardially and epicardially sequentially.
Or no more than 15 seconds, right?
Well, it's already quite a...
So the unique benefit of this is that the patient's wearing this vest the whole time during the procedure. Mm-hmm. So whatever you see observed in the inverse solution, you can confirm locally with that. There was a catheter from inside.
Or the device. Yeah. Would you induce VF several times to get, and then map different regions, or...
Well, you cannot just, it's a patient there, you cannot just keep inducing VF.
Is it more than once?
We have, on average, 2 episodes per patient. In some patients, we have induction from 2 different regions. In some patients, we have a spontaneous and an induced VF. So we can also compare how is induced comparable to clinical VF, basically. So we have some cases of that.
And this doesn't mention the therapeutic reason for doing this. Is that to do an ablation of a trigger, or?
Yes,
this is necessary.
Yeah, if they come for an EP exploration, yes, it's potentially to find the trigger and ablate them, so to reduce the recurrence of, or completely eliminate
the
recurrence.
These patients were symptomatic under. Even though they have an ICD, they're getting quite lots of
VFs and shocks,
or lots of VF storms, or both.
Yes, I think both. And actually, in one group of the patients, you'll see they have actually primary ectopics and triggers that you can ablate.
And you don't have the tapes for those patients.
No, we have the records from the.
So behind actually, so these patients, how often do they go into fibrillation in average? A week or 2 weeks?
How often? It's quite variable. I mean, we have a table in the paper where in the previous 12 months before the intervention, how many episodes they had. So it's quite variable. Some patients will have several episodes during the same day.
Yeah, so the current protocol is that, so let's say you have a patient who's a sudden cardiac arrest, lucky resuscitated, come to the hospital, and so a patient's admitted, you have some period of index at hospitalization, and you get the whole test, and cardiac angiogram, cardiac MRI, and then antigenic testing, the autoimmune testing, and the mapping, and the ICD. So so this during this test you don't really provide any therapy other than ICD, and then when the patient has a shock outside hospital, then consider some kind of intervention like ablation. So this is all for kind of some additional mechanical study that most people don't provide. For example, if we have a patient like this, had a sudden cardiac arrest, come to the hospital, we just implant a pacemaker and it's just everything blew up. So that's the kind of current practice. But they do this extensive mapping and then genetic testing and try to kind of sort out. So this patient has, for example, long QT, CPVT, or idiopathic VF. But that's definitely something new.
Okay, half of them you said have PVCs that they think are relevant.
I would say one third, yeah.
One third, yeah.
Well, I'll come back to that.
Okay,
So, and then. One final point in terms of the methods, once we get the non-invasive data reconstructed onto the epicardium, we apply phase mapping to localize rotors and focal breakthroughs. So in terms of rotors, we look for reentrant activity that rotates at least for two times. That's just the threshold. We've played with this threshold. It doesn't change much in terms of the actual results that I'll present. But we don't really make a distinction between rotating or focal activity, knowing that we're only looking on the epicardium. So a focal breakthrough may actually be underlied by an intramural reentry. So the bottom line is we call these all together the drivers, and with this phase mapping, we try to localize the drivers of VF I wouldn't say in real time, but how it evolves during this 15, 20 seconds of early VF in these patients. So first result, which was something that was not expected, is that it's maybe not entirely clear, although you can perhaps appreciate that we have in the first, let's say, 6 seconds, this is this is 10 seconds of VF, the first 4 to 5 seconds of VF appears to be more organized than what happens next. So there seems VF seems to start with an early, more or less organized phase. So organization, I'll show examples of what we mean by organization. There is organization in terms of frequency, cycle length. So the initial stage is a lower frequency, higher cycle length than the later stage, and there is a very rapid transition. Not all patients show this, but a vast majority show this behavior of an early organized stage. So this is purely based on an electrocardiographic signal processing analysis. And another observation is that even though I said we look both at rotors and focal breakthroughs, is that VF seems to be mainly driven by reentrant activity on the epicardium. Of course, cannot say what's happening inside the ventricles, inside the myocardial wall, but 88% of the wavefronts that we observe on the epicardium emanate from a reentrant source. And where there are focal breakthroughs, they appear to be dominantly originating from the right ventricle. So this is the first set of results before going into the actual, looking at the actual maps. But this was not expected. This
is one patient or
this is a single patient.
A single patient. So these sort of conclusions are
for the 24, and actually for other pathologies this holds true. Not only for idiopathic, we see this in all pathologies. And this is this is when we superimpose the 252 electrograms from the torso. We just superimpose the 252 in time. We look at time evolution. So this is the first 2 seconds, 4, 6. You can see initially it's quite organized. They're all more or less in phase, and then at around 4 or 5 seconds it starts to get completely disordered.
The beginning of this record is stimulation.
So this wasn't induced. So this
is the end of the stimulation.
That's the end of the stimulation right here, and this is VF starting. We did two types of stimulation: S1, S2, S3, S4. So just regular program simulation, and we did burst spacing as well.
Yeah, what that looks like burst spacing.
No, this is not burst. It's actually it's fairly short coupling interval, but there's only four pulses. It's not burst.
So four pulses induced. That.
Yeah, that's enough.
Coupling interval.
It's anywhere between we start with long coupling interval 300 milliseconds 250, and we go down to whatever triggers the VF. Not all patients are inducible.
So the patient is anesthetized.
Some of them will be in the general anesthesia, others will be just in the local anesthesia, and they are,
How do you compare the inducibility to a normal, completely normal?
So, I don't have the data, but we, in those patients where we have both, spontaneous and induced, in terms of what I'll show next, the organization of AF, it's comparable, it's similar. There's one thing though, burst spacing gives you completely different VF dynamics. If you apply burst spacing, you basically skip this first stage and you immediately go to a very disorganized rapid VF. You don't see this initial stage of organized VF with burst spacing.
So is the morphology of the VT there similar to the clinical morphology outside of the laboratory?
It's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell.
Probably a VT detect, VT recorded outside the hospital is probably recorded in the AED, automatic, and the defibrillator. So in the defibrillator, it's just a one lead or something. And I don't think you can say that.
Defibrillator.
Well, sometimes I have the records.
They probably do, but it's not 12 lead.
No, it's not 12 lead. You can't compare the whole.
So how long is the ICD record usually?
But this is
you mean the first time if the patient has the event?
Yes.
Usually quite long, probably like 30 seconds before, maybe 30 seconds after the each event.
But again, it's only one lead. You just have, you have only one lead. But it should be enough to detect the difference between organized and disorganized VF.
Two and three are doing the organized phase or the disorganized phase or an average of both?
This is average over the whole duration.
But then
I'll show what happens.
Focal breakthrough, for example, do they come more later or in the beginning? Because you see there are two different phases, and then you give two and three, and so.
Oh, well, look at the right canopy. So both electrograms on the left.
Yeah, but from this is torso. This is torso electrograms. So it's hard to tell.
It may be driven by reentrant activity, 80% of wavefronts. I would imagine that percentage to change between phase one and phase two. And so the focal breakthrough also, so that's, I'm just asking about that.
We've not looked at this in detail, but no, so I can't answer for sure. But still, this was a quite interesting observation that they do dominantly occur in the right ventricle, and there's some potential physiological information there. So now if we look at how is VF organized, so I took again the same tracing, and this is... Now, these are maps of the patient's heart. So the patient will undergo a CT scan. We need the anatomical information to be able to reconstruct the torso data onto the epicardial surface. And we then create those maps of... So this is the activity average here over the first 5 seconds. And we show color-coded the location, probability of finding a rotor or a focal breakthrough in any location of the heart. So red means you have a very high probability, gray means there was no detection of a driver during that time window. So you can see during the organized stage, in this patient, there was a hot spot here in the right ventricle near the RVOT, so the right ventricular outflow tract, this goes to the pulmonary artery. And there were two regions near the posterior, on the posterior and anterior wall, near the basically the insertion of left, right, and septum. Of course, we cannot see septum with this approach.
Is it upside down?
It's upside down here. So the base is here, the apex is there. And here, the apex is here, and the base is there. So this is the anterior septal area, this is the LED, and this is the posterior septal area, basal area. But bottom line is that here, and we have also shown for those rotors that we were able to track during that time window, we've shown all the trajectories here of the rotors. So it's fairly localized, as you can see. It's only a couple of regions, very localized. The same patient, just 5 seconds later, this is what VF looks like. It's much more disorganized. The rotors have started disseminating over a much larger surface area, and you start seeing drivers where you didn't see them in the initial stage. So for example, initially here the left ventricle was completely passively activated. There were no active reentrant or focal sources of VF in the left ventricle. 5 seconds later, there was a lot of activity coming from the left ventricle. Now, so we've classified patients in the occurrence of these driver regions in the organized stage. So now I'm just going to talk about the organized, the early stage of VF. Yeah?
So there's obviously a huge amount of data processing that goes into identification of where the rotor is. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's been done by others a long time ago. Yeah. But what's your degree of confidence in the accuracy of
Well, there's different things. First of all, the accuracy in localizing a rotor at a given location. So how accurate is the localization of the rotor? So we've got in silico models to test this, and we also have an experimental model. I don't have time to, with a torso, where we put an isolated heart in the torso, and we can apply all this algorithm. So the localization is of the order of a centimeter.
First, the fact that there's a rotor, you're very confident that if it says so.
Yes. Yes. I can show you. I can dig up some.
No, I mean it just.
Yeah. So.
Pretty confident about the technology.
Yes. This is also because we put a threshold of 2 rotations. Then we're pretty confident there is a rotor. If we put a threshold at a lower value, then we start getting also picking up wave breaks and. Then it's more difficult to interpret.
What is plotted here, actually?
Here is the location of rotors that last for at least 2 rotations.
You mean the center?
The center, the core, the facing polarity, that's the facing polarity of rotors that last for at least 2 rotations during the initial stage of VF. And so it's a cumulative map. And for each rotor, we actually add a spot on this map, and so where you have a lot of rotors, it's red. Where you have no rotors, it's gray.
And to create this map, is the what's the relative weight of the external non-invasive versus the
At the moment, this is all non-invasive data. There is no contact because we don't have to map a rotor. You need to have an extensive region where you can map, and all our catheters are local.
Non-invasive is good enough to take rotors.
Yeah. We lose some information by, of course, there is some loss of information because of the propagation of electrical activity from the heart to the torso. And then there is loss of information because of the regularization during the inverse solution. But for rotors, we've shown, and this comes back to Leon's question, we've shown that it's actually fairly accurate in terms of localization. Comparing the ground truth that we get with a model or with an experiment and what we reconstruct non-invasively. Yes.
And the cone recording represents occurrence or something?
It represents the density,
yes.
Density of a rotor during that, let's say, 5 second period of time. So very high.
How about the number of those rotors? Would it be true to say that there's a review of just one rotor in the organized stage, or am I mistaken?
Okay, yeah. So this is average over 5 seconds, so it's not an instantaneous snapshot. The thing is that the mean lifespan of rotors is relatively low. So we don't see long-lasting rotors. So although our threshold is a 2 rotation, we don't see many rotors that last for 10, 15, 20, 30 rotations. So there is a constant creation, annihilation of rotors. So it's very hard to answer precisely this question. We prefer, and this is also more from a therapeutic point of view, prefer to think about regions where they will occur. And it's in the organized stage, it's fairly low number of regions and very localized.
But to construct this map, you need to do the count.
Yeah, so we have the count somewhere. Yeah.
I assume those that each picture represents the one event, right? One VF event. It's not a statistics of multiple events. Right?
No, it's one.
So one event, for example, the left panel has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 regions. But
regions?
This is like an average of 5 seconds. But how many numbers, what's the number of rotors are simultaneously exist?
This is the question from Vadim. And I think I would have to check into the raw data, but it's. So anywhere, because at a single snapshot, you may have a rotor in this region, but nothing in the other regions. Or you may have a rotor in every region, or two rotors in every region. So.
But what it says in 7, don't we in 7?
So in 7 patients. So out of, so we had 19 patients, so 5 patients were non-inducible. So for 5 patients, we have no VF measurements. Out of those 19 patients where we have VF measurements, 7 have in the organized stage, all the activity in the RV, right ventricle. Only two in the left ventricle, and then in the remaining 10, half of them, it's biventricular.
Okay, but the picture is, this statistics is one story, and it's not related to the picture.
No.
It just shows
This is different, yeah. This is just one representative case of this, and I'll show some example in the next slide.
And in principle, according to those questions, you may have particular time windows in which you plot the phases and you see what is the sequence of those singularities, the activity.
Yes, well, we have the phase movies. I'll show you. Actually, the next slide, I have the phase. I can show you some example of phase movies.
So in order to solve the inverse problem, you need to have the 3D structure.
And yes.
Where does it
from CT scan. So all the patients undergo CT scans. So we have the precise location of the electrodes, the anatomy of the torso, and the anatomy of the heart. So,
Why do the time movements?
We ignore it for now.
and why did you pick the threshold in the previous slide?
Why, sorry?
Can you say why you picked the threshold of 2 rotations?
2 rotations? As I said, if we go to 1 rotation, then we see, it doesn't actually, if we pick 1 rotation, it will not change significantly the location of the drivers, but because of the smoothing, if 1 rotation, maybe it's not a true rotor, it didn't actually fully complete the rotation, it's just, so we took 2 rotations to be on the safe side, to make sure we really have a rotor, because we also have focal activity, intramural focal activity, that on the surface with phase mapping may give something that looks like rotor in some cases, but it will never completely do a 2-pi rotation. So just to be on the safe side, we took 2 rotation. And then also when you have multiple wavelets with a lot of wave breaks, then it becomes very confusing. The picture becomes confusing if you take a lower number of rotations.
What's the variability in the frequency? So you have a rotor, so you have a period also, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So what's the typical period? How much does it vary with RPL?
So we, in terms of, the clinicians reason in terms of cycle length, but the mean cycle length overall these patients is about 170 milliseconds. And it's for the idiopathic, so it will depend on the pathology.
Idiopathic,
it's fairly conserved and it's around 170 milliseconds, so a bit above 5 hertz. It's rather fast, yes.
Then what's the variability? The 170, some is 130, some are 210?
Let me check.
Well, really interesting in terms of minimum refractory period.
I probably have the numbers with the standard deviation.
Look it up later.
Here. Just check this. So here, 170, and the standard deviation is 21 milliseconds.
I see, so it's pretty small.
Yeah. This is the, so you have a jump of, well, there is an interventricular gradient, so between the right and the left. And then when you have this transition from organized to disorganized stage, it decreases by about 10, 15 milliseconds.
What is the gradient you mentioned then?
10 milliseconds, sorry, between the ventricles.
The right
is faster.
Opposite to what Khalifa observed in the
5 Hertz.
But it's 10 milliseconds, fairly small in terms of frequencies.
And this includes the programmed electrical stimulation and the burst pacing.
Only the program stimulation, because with the burst spacing we don't see the organized stage.
Okay, so this is just the program. Okay, thank you.
Sorry. Okay, so just some examples. This is a 29 years old man. This was a spontaneous VF that was recorded. And this was a case of dominant right ventricle. So this is the map during the early stage of VF. Everything happens in the right ventricle. In the left ventricle, there is no driver activity, so meaning the left ventricle is just passively activated. And this may answer partially to the question of how many rotors do you see simultaneously. But
where do you do the burst spacing from? Another burst spacing,
S1, S2, S4. Either the endocardial right ventricular apex or the left ventricular apex.
But if you took a patient like that, did it in the left ventricle?
We did this.
It's still initiating.
I don't know if it's initiating, but it's still organized from the right ventricle. Yes. So here you can appreciate. So in this case, there are about 3 to 4 rotors simultaneously.
Figure of 8.
Yeah, there's a figure of 8. There's something else up here, and there's a rotor near the anterior base here, but nothing in the left ventricle. And so this is 2.7 seconds of spontaneous VF in this patient.
There's still a lot of rotation.
This is spontaneous, yeah.
And we have the very beginning.
Well, with phase mapping, it's very difficult if you don't have, you need, but no, this is actually, I think Hiroshi is planning to work on a spontaneous initiation and
that's really interesting.
This is another case, also a 47-year-old. This is induced VF, where all, in this case, we show the rotor trajectories, but they're all in the right ventricle, nothing in the left ventricle. Another case where here we actually have a single rotor that moves around in the left ventricle.
Very stable.
Yeah, this one is relatively stable. This is a rare occurrence where we have maybe 10-15 rotations, but in general we don't see this.
Olivia, so can you please show the male ones once more, please?
The male ones.
And the format is you use a CCGC or some other more. ECG seem is something to reconstruct the echocardiogram from the. Although you just record it, you don't do a forward mapping, right?
No, it's not forward. Yeah,
so you just record.
And then.
But for the inverse, what do you use?
It's the Woody approach with the Tikhon of regularization. So it's actually the system that was developed by one of. Former student of Johan Brudy, and that's now being it's been bought by Medtronic. So the interesting thing. So now I've shown you what's happening during VF. So and here the bottom line is that during the early stage of VF, certain spots appear as being the driving regions of VF, and they're fairly well localized. So now, what about the contact mapping? Because this is all non-invasive, it has many limitations, but what actually does the contact mapping, so epi and endocardial catheter mapping, show? And what it shows is actually, I'll first move to this slide, is that if you go epicardially or endocardially with a catheter and you record during sinus rhythm, so now we're in sinus rhythm, we're not anymore during VF, you do extensive mapping in these patients, what it shows is that those regions where you had the initial drivers of VF, you see these fractionated electrograms. So fractionated electrograms are basically a signature of some local tissue abnormalities. If you're, for example, here, you're in a normal region or a region where there was no VF driver, then you see these very nice, sharp, biphasic electrograms. Now, if you go near to these regions where you have the driving activity, you see this low, also the amplitude, you can't really read it, but the amplitude changes, the scale changes, so these are fairly low amplitude, highly fractionated electrograms.
That is when the driver activity is there.
No, always. This is always. This is sinus written. So this is initially we didn't. So when we started doing this VF mapping, we didn't think we would find like specific location where something was happening, and this is based on the first maps where we found these driver regions during early VF. That then the clinicians thought, okay, well let's go and have a look. Is there something abnormal in those regions? So the catheter mapping was then guided by previous knowledge of the VF driver regions. And of course, it's sequential mapping. You cannot do this during VF. You don't have enough time. So it's during sinus rhythm. And during sinus rhythm, it appears that there is some abnormality in terms of the electrograms.
How wide are those complexes? You have a scale of that.
Yeah, well, we use the standard definition to distinguish between normal and abnormal. So we considered abnormal longer than 70 milliseconds, 70. So, and more than three deflections, so more than three fragmentations. So that's the definition we use in this study to distinguish between normal and abnormal.
And roughly it is completely normal in these patients, or there is abnormalities in the 12-lead electrogram?
No, this is idiopathic VF, so the ECG is...
But on the 12-lead electrocardiogram, nobody could read anything in it. Low QT, fractionated QT, CFAE or whatever.
Nothing, absolutely normal. The thing is, these regions are fairly small, so now we'll go back to the previous slide. So they're about 14 square centimeters on the surface, and if you compare this to the total surface, it's 4 to 5% of the total surface. So it's very small. If you didn't know there was something there, I don't think clinician would go and look for this kind of things if you didn't know there was something. And it's also fairly low procedure, so for the patient. And the thing is, remember we had 19 patients where we had VF that was mapped. 24 patients in total. In 15 patients, we found those areas of abnormal electrograms near the sites of or at the sites of VF driver regions. Small size, and very often it only involves, it's not transmural because we did epi and endo mapping, we don't find it on both sides, and very often it's only epicardial, subepicardial.
In most of the cases, it's close to the region, not. Exactly.
Close or in? I mean, it can, also inside of it, but it can expand a little bit outside.
You see, most of the cases around, or because from the picture seems it's in between, not exactly on the singularity.
It's we've done. I don't have it here. We did a measurement, so we've compared the distance of an abnormal electrogram to the sites of driver region versus all the other points of the surface. And it turns out to be very highly significant in terms of, if you look at the mean distance with the site of driver region, it's maybe the mean distances will be around 1 centimeter.
Do you have examples when you have both endo and epi going from this area?
Not here, no. Not
here. I don't know how to translate this abnormal. These are bipolar electrode. So from what's known from other studies or simulations or modeling, how does one relate this
interpret.
To interpret it? So is it a repolarization abnormality or
It's very similar to what you would see in scar tissue. For example, and the different fractionations, the different complexes is perhaps one of the interpretations is just a propagation that goes around small islands of scar or fibrosis. So it's tortuous propagation.
It's typical to scar and fibrosis.
Yeah. We use the same definition to define abnormal versus normal as what's used, for example, in infarct related.
Scar and fibrosis, so in a 29-year-old, they have a
That's I'll come back to the conclusion. That's already the question.
Do we have any data?
That's not bad here. So that kind of reflectionism, yes. So mostly scar tissue, some kind of sick myocardial tissue. But they also, for example, some idiopathic PVC cases or some kind of a focal intracardiac. We go there and if you see something like that, we drool. That's most likely the focal region. So I don't think if there's a precise electrical, structural, functional comparison done, but those are the kind of things that we typically look for as a target.
Okay. Yeah.
And what was the prevalence of this correlated with age at all? And
We haven't looked at age correlation with age.
They have
over
30.
We haven't correlated.
Quick question. Yeah. So the waveform that you record from bipolar electrode, it's really a superposition from the entire ventricle plus what you measure locally, right? So do we understand sort of what the relative contribution is?
Well, the idea of bipolar is that you only look at local, or you eliminate a lot of the far field components. That's the whole point of doing bipolar, is you look locally. You will still integrate over a certain volume of tissue, for sure, and that's why you get fractionation, because presumably you have multiple paths of propagation within the integration volume. But the point of doing bipolar is that you get rid of a lot of the bulk tissue activation.
How wide is your distance between
this? It will depend on the catheters.
Yeah. I have a follow-up question. So you said that these kind of abnormal electrograms could be due to structural problems like scar fibrosis or functional, like maybe some local topic. Mm-hmm. If you did a unipolar measurement, could you then differentiate between the two, or do you still
between focal versus
structural?
Well, definitely you're going to get a lot of far field. But if you're having some ectopathy coming from the focal source, the unipole is very helpful in the sense that then you're going to see nice kind of a Q wave with no R wave. But in that sense, probably it's not.
Yeah, and you need to catch the actual ectopic, because if you don't have the start of the
look, they are very sharp, so it cannot be visualization phase.
They won't be. Actually, the origin of this is also being debated in the context of Brugada, and Charlie and Selovich showed that if you have an action potential with a lot of phase one notching, so you have, for example, very strong ITO current, so you have phase one notching, and you have heterogeneity of this, it can also give rise to some degree of fractionation, but it's never as sharp as that. So that's the interpretation. It's more conduction, and it's probably conduction related to structural abnormalities. At least that's our interpretation. But so this we see in 2/3 of the patients, that's 65% of the patients, we see these abnormal electrograms. And the other third of the patient, we don't see abnormal electrograms, even though they have these driver regions. But what these patients have is they show a lot of Purkinje ectopic triggers. So in out of 9 patients that didn't have these abnormal electrograms, 7 have Purkinje ectopic triggers. So they have, on the normal 12 DDCG, you would see short coupled, narrow QRS PVCs, and which are related to Purkinje. You can then also do endocardial mapping, and at least if they are occurring sufficiently often, then you can go and map them and identify as coming from the Purkinje. Whereas in the patients that had the abnormal electrograms, interestingly, very few of them have Purkinje ectopy. So it looks like in the idiopathic VF population, we have perhaps two different types of pathologies, one which is related to localized structural alterations, and one that is perhaps more a trigger-related VF due to Purkinje electrical myopathy, or I don't know how you would...
Before you change, if you didn't have your endocardial mapping, can you tell that that's coming from Purkinje fiber?
I think What Michel Heidegger would usually say that short-coupled narrow theorism, there is a very high chance, it needs to be confirmed, that it comes from Purkinje, but...
You can kind of guesstimate, but you may not.
So the short, this bite down, you say, is
fairly narrow.
QRS,
yeah,
which is... And it's short because it's in the Purkinje system.
Well, the narrow could be because of the Purkinje system, or it could be from the septum. But if you look at the Li1, that's the negative deflection medium, this is from left to right. And then the V1 is positive medium, this is from LV origin. And if you look at 2, 3, 8, it's mainly negative, meaning that this is from bottom to top. So like, so what kind of the bottom, from the left ventricle, bottom to top kind of a configuration.
Right.
And Purkinje and the ultimate way you're going to have to put the catheter and decide that it's, by looking at it, probably it's possible. We can say.
And you show it himself.
No, he will say the same as yours. He'll say it's likely to be, and then only
that's terrific.
Were there patients that had no Purkinje abnormality of that type and no structural?
No. They either had one
or the other.
Or the other or both. There's a couple with that had both.
Actually, four out of here had both.
But is there a control, I mean, in a sense, if you take somebody without it, well, I guess you don't, but...
I
would be curious to be an epiphenomena. Correlation is not causality.
Yeah, I agree, but...
Well, this you would detect in a echocardiogram, so this you would know in normal people. This you would see, but the other one...
The other one you can't see.
You can't see, and whether it's there or not...
And then, well... Just to conclude this study, what was interesting is that now we can potentially use, I'm not a clinician, but this information about location of early VF drivers as an ablation target. So there is a region of abnormal structure, maybe abnormal electrophysiology, this remains to be debated. So this is epicardial signals from this, you can see here the points where it has been mapped, corresponds to this region. You can see the highly fractionated nature of those electrograms. And then you can ablate those regions until you get, so the fractionation is abolished. So this is after ablation. And then in those, this wasn't done in all patients, but in those patients where this was done, they were then followed up for 18 months. And only one had a recurrence of VF. All the others had no recurrence of VF, knowing that in the first place, these are people who had quite often VF, otherwise they wouldn't have come to the EP lab. So it seems to help for guiding therapy, and it seems to be a potential ablation target, but the precise mechanisms remain, well, debated. Or
ablation of early drivers.
It's probably what we think of as, and I'll show some. It's ablation of. It's more like a substrate ablation. In the Purkinje, in the other group of patients, so in the 1/3 that had Purkinje triggers, this is actually the ablation procedure has been described for many years already by Michel and other workers, and this is already more, I wouldn't say standard procedure, but something that has been done for longer to identify where do the triggers come from and ablate those spots. This was done for a longer time. But here, it's actually showing some evidence of a structural substrate that may be a target for ablation. Yeah.
But so in patients, so you probably don't know this, I'm sorry. But in patients who have frequent premature ventricular complexes, what percentage of those may have the morphological characteristics described by Hiroshi that may be associated with a Purkinje? Do you have any notion?
How many of the patients with PVCs that actually comes from Purkinje?
You know, yeah, just, you know, like, is it 5%? Is it 50%? I don't. I have no
notion. I don't know, but it's rare. Yeah, and most of the PVC that we see in our ambulatory population is just a PVC from RVOP, mm-hmm. LVOP.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we get a lot of referral bias. You know, if you have a very simple PVC, just go to private practice. But the university hospital, we have more rare cases. But the Purkinje origin is extremely rare. We sometimes get some moderate bands and puff muscles, but the Purkinje origin is very rare.
But if you had the, like, if if I go to my doctor and I have that electrocardiogram,
previous one,
my 10-second sequence, he wouldn't send me to you based on that, or would he?
No, probably.
You wouldn't know how to read it.
Start with
but you're going to get some routine exams, make sure you don't have any,
Right.
blockages and heart functions.
Right, so that wouldn't lead to a referral to see you, even though maybe it should.
Most people do okay.
Yeah.
Most people do okay who have that.
Maybe I can let me put it the other way around. Of all the patients that do come in the EP lab in Bordeaux, so these are patients with known that have had VF episodes.
Right, right.
So this is different. This is a subgroup of this population.
Right. No,
of
so that's why I was asking the question of the.
But in those patients, there is a very high prevalence of Purkinje triggers, irrespective of pathology. Here, I only show idiopathic, but in ischemic heart disease, the only group of patients where we don't see Purkinje triggers are the Brugada. But all the others, they have very high incidence of Purkinje ectopy. But these are patients that are, that came to us because they have VF. So.
You think that initiation of the VF is related to those regions, the initiation area?
I'll show, we're doing some simulations. I'll show some results about the potential mechanism. If you don't have a Purkinje trigger, what may actually, how can it start? Just one, also kind of a side result is, so for a couple of years now, we've been collaborating with the legal medicine department in Bordeaux, and so we've had access to some human hearts from autopsies. So. And there was a case of a young lady, 33 years old, who died suddenly, no cardiovascular history, and at autopsy, so this is macroscopic gross examination, at least the heart looked perfectly normal. So we got this heart, we couldn't do any functional imaging, so but we could do structural imaging. So we have a 9.4 Tesla wide bore MRI, and actually, so when the heart. So this was imaged at 150 micron resolution, and this heart showed some regions of enhanced signal. So this is a gadolinium perfused. So the heart was perfused with gadolinium, and so enhanced signal could indicate fibrosis, inflammation, at least some abnormalities. So in the right ventricle, it went a bit fast, but near the apex of the right ventricle, there was some evidence of a very localized region of some abnormalities. And then this is here what you'll see appearing a little bit further on. Near the base of the left ventricle on the anterior side, we also had some evidence of some structural abnormality. And it's very localized. You can't see it just by visual inspection. You probably wouldn't be able to see it on a clinical MRI because of the resolution issues. And the bulk of the myocardium appears to be perfectly normal. It's just in two very localized region, we saw some abnormalities. It's quite regulated, but it's we've had now. I mean, we also have a donor human heart program, and so we've had many hearts, and they are more trabeculated than some other animal species.
So open hearts, even at 30 years old, look so fatty on the outside.
Some of them, yes. Yeah,
it's kind of this faint region of scar, right? And then you see some thinning of the region there. So this is not something that happened acutely, so that's for sure. This is not acute myocardial.
No.
But if you look at the distribution, I'm not sure that there's not corneal. Oh, but this patient had an autopsy, and then there's no corneal artery.
No, we can't tell because
it's only 32. But
this is only 32. It's not, and it's an autopsy, so it's not a patient. It's somebody without suddenly.
Yeah, but they can look up the coronary artery.
Yeah, well, Marcus. Yeah, no, there were no, because we actually we still have the heart, so we'll do histology on this heart as well. But there was no evidence for coronary artery disease.
I shouldn't ask, but I want to ask you. So, was there any QA of alternates that is still or any kind of signature of alternates?
I don't know.
Absolutely, I should not ask. Absolutely.
This person or in the patients?
Or just any of those patients, was there any signature of T wave?
It's well, as far as I know, it's not been tested, and there is no evidence for alternates. Like,
yes, I know.
Some of the 19 patients, how many were female?
I have the stats somewhere. I think half. It's more or less half.
Okay. The one example, functional example that you showed with drivers in the LV, that was a female parrot.
Yes, it's just.
You look whether that.
Whether sex plays a role, yeah. No, we haven't looked at this yet. It may be interesting, but again, sample size is very small. So, okay, and so just to conclude on this first part, sure, I'll get to the end of my talk. So we start with Sasha Panfilov and Hans Dukes to actually put this information into a computation model. So they got the geometry, they see just of the heart from one of the patients, a CT scan, and then they actually manually included a region. It's a very large region here, but a region of subtle structural alterations. So basically some sort of a localized region of diffuse fibrosis. And so when you do, let's say, S1 regular apical stimulation, this is the kind of activation patch that you see. You see some percolation phenomenon into this diffuse fibrotic region, but nothing really abnormal happens. But then if you start doing S1, S2, S3 stimulation, then...
Did the fiber field also from the CT scan?
No, this is, was...
structural.
It's... You have the anatomy, and then they implement, it's a rule-based fiber orientation that they implement into this anatomy. So that's, that's limitation. But then if you do here S1, S2, S3 apical stimulation, then you can actually set the stage for a conduction block within this fibrotic region and re-entry. So just start. So this is the end of S, this is S3, I think. And then you can see here re-entry starts. And that's the initiation, basically. So if you do this kind of pacing, S1, S2, S3, in a structurally normal geometry, then you wouldn't get wave break. You wouldn't expect to get a wave break, at least not at those cycle lengths that we have here. But just including a region of structural abnormality with some diffuse fibrosis, you do get this kind of wave breaks and then unidirectional block.
The size of this region matches the sort of mean region where you saw abnormal electrogram. Can you
yes,
remind me
what that was? Yes, so in the patient was about 14 square centimeter. I think they tested a whole range. This is a larger one, so 12 square centimeters. So it's comparable.
It was quite big.
This is bigger. Yeah, actually there may be... No, this...
Across the whole thickness of the...
No, only through half. They did different things. They did transmurally only half of the thickness, so this is only half of the thickness.
Only half works as well, right?
Yeah.
Shouldn't the patient's size in it?
It was 14. Right. But I think there must be a typo. I think they went up to 22, and this is one of the larger ones.
So do they compare the cycle length? And the sequence with what's actually
they match what was done in the clinic, yes. In terms of
cycle. That's a cycle length by tuning a diffusion coefficient or something, or do you think that they have that starting out?
I'm not sure.
Because the models, or the size of the patch may determine.
Yeah. The cycle length of the actual reentry, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so this, no, we haven't looked further than just the initiation.
I see.
Because what the model doesn't yet predict is the acceleration, so going from an organized phase to a disorganized, faster phase. Maybe this there is, if we'll implement some sort of spiral wave breakup falling onto that, maybe we'll get there. But
to inform these kind of models, because can get anything from you did normal pacing to image this abnormal electrogram regions, right?
Yeah.
Can you get conduction velocity information during normal, not during VF, from the external, because you can map
yes, if the problem is all the pacing was done endocardially. We map epicardially, so we're not measuring true conduction velocities. You mean in the patient, right?
Yeah, in the patients.
And all the other mapping was on a sinus rhythm, where you can't. It's you just see breakthrough on the epicardium.
Yes. So
Because that would be really useful.
Yeah, I agree.
Get some kind of.
In other cases, for example, we also use the non-invasive ECGI for resynchronization therapy, where they will test different pacing locations, also epicardial pacing locations. There we do have information about activation sequence, and we could potentially calculate conduction velocities. But then the problem, these are fairly sick patients, so whether you can use it for this.
So in looking at this, I don't actually see it rotating around that.
I don't know. It just actually.
I see it kind of going off and then coming in again from 5 o'clock.
So, okay, I should pause it at the start. It's very preliminary data, and it's actually not showing the. Can I actually pause? No, I cannot pause it. But the first three beats are actually the paced. This is the S1, S2, S3 from the apex.
Oh. Okay.
And then we just stopped here. This is the reentry. So this is it started again. S1.
It looks like an atomical reentry. At least for the first two
beats. The first two beats. But then we didn't go further. So it's perhaps a bit confusing, but the first activity that you see is still the stimulated activity from the apex. And then we stop the simulation once we get the stage for unidirectional block and one reentry. Here, this is reentry. Oops.
I don't know how much is known about the fibrotic tissue to construct the model.
Oh, this is a.
Representative.
This is a
conceptual.
Yeah, okay. It's a proof of concept. That's all it is. And
it's your assumption that it's fibrotic area. It's not the case, right?
It may not be the case. That's the assumption. So basically, the conclusion of the study is that in 2/3 of the patients, we think there is some localized structural abnormalities. Is it fibrosis? Is it something else? Don't know, but some localized structural abnormalities that will lead to some complex propagation pattern that can be observed as fractionated electrograms in contact mapping. And in the other third of the patient, there will be a Purkinje abnormality that leads to initiation, Purkinje triggers and initiation of VF. And both, actually, that's the interesting thing, is that both can then be used as targets for ablation, potentially curing those patients, not symptomatically treating them with an ICD, but potentially curing them. But again, that's a small group of patients. This has to be confirmed in, if possible, larger scale studies. But so that's the first part of the talk. I had three parts.
The 4 o'clock is.
At 12 o'clock, we need.
This room is available at 2 o'clock. Can you
continue until 12 and then reconvene?
No, but maybe I'll just go to the final part.
Tomorrow
is, I'm actually leaving tomorrow afternoon already, so one thing is we used this same approach in also different patient populations. So I told you about the primary electrical disorder. So we've looked at J-wave syndromes, Brugada, early repolarization, also in ischemic cardiomyopathy, myocardial infarction. And the bottom line is that even in Brugada and in early repolarization, we also find evidence, not in all patients, but in some patients, we find evidence for these regions of localized structural abnormalities. And we had, I'll just show this for this part, but we had the opportunity. So we have a human donor heart program at Bordeaux. So these are patients, people come in the hospital, declared brain dead. So the heart cannot be used for transplantation for different reasons. Age is often a reason. So above 65 years old, hearts from donors are not being used anymore for transplantation. And so with consent from the family, we can then get those hearts and study them in the lab using optical imaging, using MRI, so all the tools we have in the lab. So we've had about 30 hearts over the last 3 years, but interestingly, one of the hearts, so we get the ECG from the patient, and one of the hearts came with this ECG, with this very typical J-wave, actually very pronounced J-wave. So this slurring or notching of at the end of the QRS. So this is a case of early repolarization syndrome, and there's been a big debate also for Brugada, which is very similar, but it's localized in the right ventricle, whether it's a repolarization abnormality. So is this hump due to a region of the heart that shows like, so is this actually an early T wave, or is it a late QRS? So is it an early repolarization, or is it a late depolarization? So, for example, Charlie Anselovich is a big proponent of the early repolarization hypothesis, and then the Amsterdam group claims it's related to depolarization. So anyway, so we had the opportunity to work on one of those hearts, and we did. So we isolated the left ventricle and did optical imaging. Unfortunately, we didn't get any good quality signals from the epicardium, also because of epicardial fat. But we mapped the endocardium, and bottom line here is what we found is we found both conduction and repolarization abnormalities. So compared to five other normal hearts, so with no early repolarization like ECG, we found that in this heart, in the left lateral part of the left ventricle, we found shorter action potentials than all the other non-syndrome of control hearts. But also we found this very complex activation patterns with lines of conduction block with very long activation time, total activation time of the left ventricle compared to controls. So in this heart, it has both. It has delayed depolarization and early repolarization. But then what is actually causing this notching of...
What are the controls?
Controls are other donor hearts without cardiovascular problems, and especially without any evidence of an early repolarization ECG phenotype. They're not age-matched because we only have that many hearts we can work with, but that's, I guess, the best comparison we can achieve in this group of hearts. And so we had volume-conducted ECGs, so in our bath, experimental bath, where we have the ventricle that's perfused and the optical imaging, we also have volume-conducted ECGs. And so this is from this early polarization heart. We have this notching. It's not like in clinical ECG, but we have this abnormality at the end of the QRS, some ST elevation notching, which we don't see in a normal heart. And actually, when you superimpose on the same trace the action potentials recorded from different regions in the left ventricle, what appears is that this notching is not due to a region of early repolarization, is actually due to this very much delayed region of activation of depolarization. So, and now we're doing some histology. It's qualitative. We haven't quantified it yet, but it looks like this heart had perhaps more interstitial fibrosis. It had also this line of conduction block that's near one of the papillary muscles, the anterior papillary muscle, and it had this very loose, maybe like non-compaction type of structure compared to a normal heart where the papillary muscle junction with the myocardial wall is very dense, and this is in this heart. So perhaps there might be a structural component to it. I don't know yet for sure, but what was interesting is this from this one heart, both we see both depolarization and repolarization abnormalities, but the ECG phenotype is actually in this case due to a depolarization abnormality, not repolarization. 5 more minutes. I'll skip this. This was we've talked. I think there were on Monday some interesting discussions about measuring conduction velocities in 3D and what does a surface measurement mean in terms of conduction velocities. So just wanted to show this because I think in tissue, one of the only groups that has actually carefully measured in 3D conduction velocity, it's the group from Bruce Neal in Auckland, where they did measurements with plunge needle electrodes and these three-dimensional activation maps, and showed that in cardiac tissue there is orthotropic propagation. So there are three main directions of propagation, and this relates back to their work on cardiac microstructure, that it's not only uniaxial anisotropy, but fibers are also organized in sheetlets, which have a very complex organization, and so you have three main directions of propagation. So you have the longitudinal, which is of course, still the fastest. But then you have the in-plane transverse and the out-of-plane transverse conduction losses. And these are the kind of ratios that they measured, so 4 to 1.8 to 1. So you have really, it's an orthotropic diffusion. It's not a
ratio of velocities.
Of velocities, yes, of velocities. And as far as I know, that's the only study that has, at least experimentally, carefully measured this in 3D.
How do they measure conduction distances?
So from isochronal maps, so with plunge needle electrodes, they reconstructed isochronal maps, 3D isochronal maps, and then calculated. This was sheep. They did it in vivo, ex vivo, and then they compared to the structure and showed that it actually correlates quite well with the fiber organization and the sheetlet organization.
8 to 1 is very large.
4 to 1. So I think in terms of conduction,
1.8 to 1, I see.
Yeah, it was about something like 70 centimeters per second, 30 and then 15, something like that. But that's okay, so that's with plunging needle electrodes, relatively low spatial resolution. And so now for many years, and this is work started when I was in Arkady's lab, I've been trying to develop optical methods to do actual 3D measurements. And so also I think quite relevant to what Elizabeth presented yesterday. So as you know, or maybe you don't know, but optical imaging in its conventional approach, you will illuminate excitation light on one surface of the heart and record from that same surface. So it's always been assumed as a surface measurement, but we know that photon propagate to some extent into tissue, so it's kind of an average measure over a subsurface volume. But it remains fairly, let's say, it remains surface information. Now the ventricles, especially in large mammalian species and human, can be quite thick, so how do we get information from deeper inside the myocardial wall? So Arkady many years ago already proposed to use transillumination to actually already probe deeper into the tissue. So instead of illuminating light on one surface, so here it's endo, it could be epi, looking from the same surfaces, exciting the tissue on one surface and looking at the fluorescence coming out from the other side. So you do this in a wedge preparation and you look at the transillumined signal. And then you can use photon propagation models to actually show that if you record in transillumination mode, you will gain information about deeper layers into the myocardium. So this is the percent contribution of each layer to the signal that you will record here. So you see it shifted. It's lower amplitude because it's transillumined, but it's shifted towards the end layers of the tissue. And so they showed in that first paper on transillumination that they had one case where, Akani can tell much more about this, but where they had a case of intramural reentry, so there was no there were no phase singularities, so no intersection of the filament with the epicardial or endocardial field of view. So on the epi or endo, you would see breakthrough patterns, but actually using transillumination, they showed that you could, they actually could propose this type of activity based on transillumination signals where the were phase singularities appearing in the deeper layers. So this was, I think, a first step, a first glimpse into what you can achieve optically to go deeper into the myocardium. Then more recently, they further developed this because initially I think it was all done sequentially. You would illuminate endo, do some recordings, then illuminate epi, do some other recordings. And so more recently they developed, based on a laser and a spinning wheel, a system that would very rapidly alternate illumination from epi and endo and acquire four images simultaneously. So two in fluorescence, two in reflection, two in transillumination. And they showed that this could actually be used to localize excitation sources fairly precisely within the myocardium. So I won't spend many details. We can discuss this later, or also with Arkady if you want. But basically, with plunge needles electrodes, they were stimulating at different depths into the tissue, and they showed that using these four images that you get, you could actually estimate the precise origin, depth of these sources. You see here very nice correlation between the actual depth of stimulation and the detected, calculated, or measured depth of detection. And we've been working further on this for a couple of years now, and using another approach to actually gain even more information is using dual wavelength imaging. So some of the new voltage-sensitive dyes, they now have a very broad excitation spectrum, and so you can excite them in very short wavelengths and very long. The reason why this is interesting is that short wavelengths don't penetrate very deep into tissue. Long wavelengths do penetrate much deeper into tissue. So by comparing recordings made with short wavelength versus long wavelength, you can qualitatively get some information about depth. So we did this a while back already on a rat heart. Just very rapidly at a 1 millisecond cycle, alternating excitation, green, red, green, red. We actually could show, by only measuring from the epicardium, evidence for a transmural APD gradient in the rat heart. So with lower action potentials with the red excitation, so that goes deeper, and shorter action potential with the green that remains on the epicardial surface. And so we validated this through simulation, but also by actually MEP recordings that we into the cavity. So we did endocardial versus epicardial electrical recording and showed that what we were seeing was a true electrical gradient using this approach. And so now what, just have two
we
more slides.
We actually have a meeting with the KITP director who is waiting for us.
Right. You can
it's,
well.
It's just two more slides.
Yeah. But, okay. I would want to see this. I just don't know if it's okay.
We can discuss in So what we basically now are doing is combining all these imaging modalities, so transillumination versus epifluorescence, and the two wavelengths. So basically, we have a system where we have a dual camera system. So we have a wedge of tissue, perfused wedge of tissue, two cameras, and on each side we have two wavelengths, two LEDs, so one green and one red. And so we alternate between first illuminating the epicardium with green, then the endocardium with green, then the epi or the endo with red, and then the epi with red. And for each illumination, we record two images, so we have two cameras, so we always have one transilluminated signal and one reflection signal. And so in total we accumulate eight images. So two cameras, two wavelengths, two modes, reflection, transillumination. Yeah, quasi-simultaneous.
How deep can you go in a 2 centimeter wall?
We can, so we have basically eight images, and each image comes from a certain depth, a mean depth. It's average, but it's mean depth, and we can get transillumination with red light through a 2 centimeter thick left ventricle, for example. With green light, it's more challenging, but with red light, it's definitely feasible. And so this cycling takes, it's 0.5 milliseconds per cycle. So we finish the whole acquisition cycle in 2 milliseconds, so meaning our effective temporal resolution is 2 milliseconds, which is, I think, acceptable for cardiac imaging. And so this is the type of recordings that we get. So of course, transillumination, so the light has to go through, penetrate through the tissue. You get lower intensity and more noisy signals, especially with green light. This is, okay, this is average trace, but this is actually the raw trace. So you see it's very noisy. It's less noisy with red light. The bottom line is that now we have those eight images. We have this photon transport model that can tell us where each image or what the depth contribution was of each image that we record. And so we can sort those images according to these different depths. Again, it's not a precise 3D depth resolve reconstruction. It's more like a classification for going from epi to endo. And in this case, we're pacing epi. So these are activation maps for all the different maps. We're pacing epi. And so this is the activation map obtained by epifluorescence with green light. So this is the most epicardial image that we have from all those eight. And then if you look at the next one, would be here, epi with red light. So now we're shining on the epicardium with red light, measuring from epicardium. We're a little bit deeper into the tissue, but still on the epicardium. So the sequence would be from here to here, and then, well, then you have to go, but it's just to give you an idea of how you can actually build a 3D activation map. So at the moment, what we're doing is just a very simple approach where we stack those different images according to the mean depths that we've calculated. And so we can get 3D activation maps, PD maps, repolarization time maps. And we validate this by using plunge needle electrodes, so simultaneous plunge needle recordings at different depths, so superimposing for action potentials from those depths with electrical recordings. You can see it's quite, so visually it's, you can see the onset of the QRS corresponds with the depolarization, the T-wave corresponds to repolarization. Then if you do quantitative analysis in terms of activation time differences between the electrical versus the optical recordings, we have actually very good correspondence. In the center of the prep, it's a bit less good, but that's where the signal is the most noisy. But overall, we're around 2 milliseconds accuracy, and that's basically our time resolution of the system. So we're within our time resolution, so this is actually meaning it's performing very well. In terms of APD versus ARI, so activation recovery interval, we're doing actually quite well as well. So we think that based on this data, it's actually, without doing any, I would say, fancy solution of an inverse problem, and a bit like what Arkady initially did with transillumination, just comparing fluorescence with transillumination, we can get some useful 3D information about
Maybe now you can trace the universe, because now
you have
twice as much
information. We have twice as much information as...
And then the strongest signal we have now from the surface with green light.
Yeah.
You have this high contrast, you can probably...
That's one of the plans, and also with...
Immobilized tissue,
yes, for optical imaging. But for activation mapping, we don't need to immobilize it, so we could use it on a contracting heart, but only for activation mapping.
Have you tried to calculate the anisotropy ratios to see how it compares?
Not yet. This is very recent data. But and also, we have as a side result, but this is sheep data. When we paste the endocardium, for example, we very often capture the Purkinje system, and then we get very complex activation maps because Purkinje in sheep is transmural, not unlike human, where it's subendocardial. So, but this is more like a technical consideration.
Just DLP that it's that slice there. It's just
this is data from left ventricle. We've done left, right, sheep, pig, human. So.
You've done human.
Yeah. So in the human left ventricle, which is thicker than the average sheep left ventricle, we sometimes lose some of the images. We don't get good green transillumination, so meaning we have one layer where we have no information, but we can still have some 3D information. And so now what we started to do is induce VF in those preparations. And so this is, again, very preliminary, but the type of things that we can do is look at VF using phase mapping. So these are two cycles of VF, one where we had evidence of some focal activity going from endo to epi, and one where we had here just on the epicardium, subepicardially, a phase singularity. Probably we had a filament that then went out of the a U-shape, or maybe an L-shape, I don't know, filament that went out of the field of view. But so that's the kind of things that we're doing at the moment, and so this is work under progress. And so I'd like to stop there.
When you mentioned focal activity, would it be more or less the same frequency as your what you call real activity, or is it a remarkably different frequency?
In where? In the clinical data or?
Clinical data or here, whatever.
For focal, we don't consider the repetitiveness of the focal. Just one focal breakthrough will be counted, but we don't look at whether it reoccurs at the same spot and what the frequency, the cycle is.
Right. So it may not be even periodic at all.
It may not be periodic at all, yes. And in many cases, we just have one focal breakthrough at one given moment of time, and then it will be somewhere else, but it won't repeat at the same spot.
But the frequency of fibrillation still is very high. This is kind of...
Yeah, in those patients, it's a bit above 5 Hertz. Okay. So, yeah, it's
if you can, if you look at frequency, the frequency is the rotor frequency.
Yes.
This fibrillation. Although the
yes. Okay. Yes. No. Thank you. Yes, that's right. I mean, so you mentioned that there was mainly focal activity in the heart in the clinical data.
Yes. Well, actually, I had an example, but I didn't have time to show it. And this is.
Most of the exam, and that's during the organized or during the okay.
This was not distinguished. This is an exam. This is a Brugada, but as I said, Brugada and it's fairly similar. But this is an example of focal activity coming specifically from the right ventricle. So in this case, it's repetitive at least for a while, and then it will get disorganized. You will have a spiral wave that starts. There has been a wave break somewhere. A spiral wave starts there. So
this outflow track.
This is near the outflow track, yes. Yeah. So it's that's
for those who don't know, the outflow track has a very
specific structure.
Pipe organization. It has like two layers per almost perpendicular.
The right ventricular
outflow. The right ventricular outflow track, yes. And it has electrophysiological properties which are different than the rest of the right ventricle. It has less connexin, less sodium channel, so yeah.
And it's often the source of arrhythmia, which can be ablated based on the anatomical location.
Yep.
Yeah, anatomical and the function of the protocols that we give the sodium channel blocker in ablation and kind of define the extent of abnormality in RVOT and in the ablation.
And the ablation generally works.
Well, so far, it's quite new, but the series of 140-150 patients outcome is pretty good. But this focal activity, there's really this example is a driver, but you saw it in a lot of the patients that there was a lot of focal activity in the RP. And did that focal activity correlate within the structural abnormality that you measured
yes,
during normal pacing?
We had we did one study where we looked at in those patients where we have focal and rotors. So all the data I've shown you so far, we pooled everything, but then we looked separately and they co-localize. It's not like one region will be only focal, one region will be only rotor. They appear to come from the same. There's a co-localization between focal trigger and substrate in all those patients.
You can still tell apart, which it may not be at the resolution of the mapping so easy to tell if you have reentry or focal. But you can tell.
Yeah, we have a problem with spatial resolution in these things. This approach, I agree. And also, again, it's only epicardial, so what we see as a focal breakthrough maybe a reentry, intramural reentry. Or
but the focal did correlate with the abnormal.
Yeah.
So that was a fantastic thought.
Yeah.
So if you go back to your first slide, you were defining the clinical problem, mm-hmm. which is that most sudden cardiac death is occurring in people with which don't show up. Your histogram thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it showed, although I couldn't read all
the
things on it. But
that's the epidemiological.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right?
Here.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah. So the top thing is that most of the sudden cardiac death is occurring in people that don't have any known abnormalities.
Well, they may have been asymptomatic and they may have had something, but
that's right.
Being
but
asymptomatic.
At the moment, it's unknown. So you're coming from one of the world leading groups that's looking at these problems. And do you have a strategy or ideas about attacking that top bar?
Well,
what is doing?
Based on this study on idiopathic ventricular fibrillation, if there was a way to screen population for those tiny localized tissue alterations, then maybe this could be a risk marker. But at the moment,
But you said that in a certain percentage of those people,
there are
PVCs.
Yes.
Now we don't know whether the characteristics of those PVCs may be different than characteristics of PVCs in patients who are in different
and that will be at risk of sudden cardiac death, VF.
That's right. I mean, that's something which you do know is in a large percentage or a certain percentage of that population, and it's not being analyzed.
Well, again, I think it's a matter of patient population. So, for example, you are looking at a very selected patient population, mm-hmm. sudden death and PVC. Oh, okay. So again, correlation is not the correlation, but if you look at everybody who has a PVC, we're talking about a very, very tiny fraction of people who might have a risk of sudden death. Mm-hmm. So if you want to, yes, you could try to develop some kind of strategy to screen out those tiny, tiny portion of patients. But that would require probably a very rigorous analysis. I don't know exactly how to approach it.
So it's possible that that record before the arrest, that the PVCs in that record have dynamical characteristics similar to the other 99% of the people who are not having cardiac arrest. But it's also possible that there are some distinctive features in that, or that there are subsets of people with distinctive features, and we're never going to know until we study it. In patients who have dynamic characteristics where you think you know the mechanism, that's also suitable for doing theoretical modeling and analysis.
I agree.
Anyway, this is my business.
Yeah. But so from the jacket external recording during normal sinus rhythm of those patients, that would also not give any clue of anything. Right?
No, that's the whole problem, because it smooths so much the signal, so we can't see.
And even in the one where you said there was the Purkinje PVCs, but no structural abnormality, from the epicardium or endocardial mapping, but it could be intramural.
Potentially, it could be. It would have to be fairly localized because, even with the catheter, you probe up into some distance.
I see the map of PVCs sometimes. You're getting.
Yeah, but there are patients with PVCs and no structural abnormalities, and so the point is that these could be.
The slide on the size of those regions, because I wanted to know whether. So you showed that they were different regions, typically in a patient, right? So is that 14 centimeters square, including the sum of...
It's the sum. It's a total.
It's the sum.
It's a sum. And it's...
But what's the average size of one patch, just so we can...
I guess it will be patient-dependent. If you have 3 or 4 patches per patient, then you just divide this number roughly by... So it will be 3 to 4 square centimeters.
Okay, so a couple of centimeters. It's not that small, actually.
Yes and no, but because what's in, so that's the patch of, okay, so that's the patch of driver locations. It may not be exactly the same patch of abnormal electrograms, and the abnormal electrograms...
No, sorry, I'm not asking about those patches. Yeah, so those were the one of the rotors from the external mapping.
Yeah.
I'm asking about the size of the patch once you went back during normal sinus rhythm and validated and found co-location of the two. How big were those patches?
We have only quantified from the driver maps. So
I see.
The size is one thing, but then if it's diffuse fibrosis and it's only, let's say, subepicardial, for any imaging technology to see this, it's going to be very challenging in vivo in patients. It's going to be so, and that's the bottom line.
You can move your electrode because you're doing sinus rhythm, so you have time.
Yeah.
You can map what's the size of the region where you see these abnormal electrodes.
Yeah. Well, we have most likely all this data, so we could extract it. No, I was more reasoning in terms of can we screen patients
I'm not asking about screen, I'm just asking in terms of informing modeling or just mechanism of what would be that size of this abnormal electrogram.
But I think this gives a good indicator.
It would be similar to this, probably.